Nicholas, thank you so much for inviting us to join you this day and this entire week of maritime thoughts and deliberations here in London. It's a great treat for me to be moderating this crude tanker panel. I, at Marsoft, have been working for more than 30 years and trying to understand the market cycles and the shipping markets and where they're taking us. And I'm delighted to be here at a time when Martin Stofford and I agree that the cycles are positive and that there's opportunity throughout. In fact, my only disagreement so far today is with the previous moderator, who said he thought that the product tanker market would be the first of the markets to turn. In fact, our analysis kind of leads us more towards the crude tanker market. Yeah. So thank you, panelists, for giving me the opportunity to speak to it. I tell you what, rather, I think you can read about the panelists in the book, but I hope that maybe each one of you could introduce yourselves, talk a little bit about your company, and then we'll start with some of the questions we've discussed.
Okay. Yeah, my name is Lars Barstad. I'm here on behalf of Frontline Limited. I'm the commercial director of Frontline. Most of you might know our company, but we own a fleet of VLCCs, Suezmaxes, and Aframaxes.
Lois Sabraki, and I'm the CEO of International Seaways. And we have 56 vessels, which includes LNG, FSO, and largely conventional tankers. We're diversified. We have both crude and product.
I'm Bob Burke. I'm CEO of Ridgebury Tankers. We're a private company sponsored by Riverstone, which is a private equity group, which is often a dirty word in these rooms. but we never ordered any ships. We bought everything secondhand. We have mostly crude and also some product tankers.
Yeah, my name is Scott Gayton. I'm the CFO of Tanker Investments Limited, as well as VP Finance in the TK Group. So I wear multiple hats representing multiple different companies as well as different industries.
Hi, I'm Paul Durham. I'm the CFO of Tsakos Energy Navigation, or TEN, as we like to call it. We have 65 tankers, crude, product, and a couple of LNG carriers.
Thank you all very much. A couple of LNG carriers. That's a very modest way of describing that position, I think. I'd just like to lead off with a question about Houston in Florida. We've seen these horrific images of the cities, the people, and of course the refining and oil industries. How have those hurricanes and the flooding affected our business, and how have they affected your operations, if at all? Lois?
For us, Arlie, we've got a lightering operation that's headquartered down in Houston, and we've got a couple guys that run the Galveston warehouse, but our team was personally very lucky. They didn't really, have very much damage and no real loss. So I think the first thing you always think of as, seafarers and, where are your vessels and, my head of operations sent me a picture the other day and said, seriously, with a question mark, because Hurricane Jose was actually out going in a square. And, it's really complex when you have three major hurricanes in a similar region with all your vessels there. So I think, everything has been safe and operations have been good. The markets on the crude side, you've just had crude oil not able to come into the U.S., and the refineries haven't, there's still a few million barrels a day not running, right? So they haven't been able to bring the crude in, and it hasn't been used, and you haven't been able to export some of your crude from the U.S. So the markets in the Caribbean on the Aframaxes responded, but it was very thin response. So you're sort of waiting to see how everything is going to settle out.
Anyone else have any disruption of their activity, Bob? Any?
No disruptions to our operations. We had a couple of ships in the Gulf, but they were safe. The short-term reaction, there were some MRs fixed at higher rates, and they would drop on subjects a little bit later where the market came up a little bit. I think there probably is a medium-term impact. Inventory's been run down. I mean, it's been chipped away at over the past 6 months or so, but I think this may have a bigger impact. And then it's going to be interesting, as the brokers always say, it's interesting to note what's going to happen with this gasoline shortage in Florida. They've suspended the Jones Act for 10 days, and it's gotten a lot of publicity. So that's a whole other story.
The Jones Act suspension for 10 days, I'm not sure everyone here in London is familiar with what that might mean. Could you
The Jones Act is a cabotage law in the U.S., and there's a whole vested interest financially and emotionally for the Jones Act. And with the shortage of gasoline in Florida, I mean, Florida's a peninsula, really. There's no way to get there. There's only one way to get there, and that's from the top. So oil can't be trucked in very efficiently. It can be barged in, but the government suspended the Jones Act for the next 10 or 15 days so foreign flagships can bring gasoline in. And people are mad there's no gasoline. I mean, we're Americans. We like our cars, especially when we need to escape, and then we need to get back into the state. It's still an issue.
Thank you. Anyone else on the disruption?
Yeah, on the kind of larger crude markets, it hasn't really affected us much. Kind of uncertain itineraries on Suezmaxes has kind of made the market a bit, you know, firm a little bit. But I think a little bit longer term, we see refinery margins basically across the globe improving quite a bit. And this could kind of trigger, you know, we're coming out of, you know, the lows of global turnarounds. And in a high margin environment, so hopefully crude runs will increase, which is eventually potentially good for the big tankers.
Very interesting. So you see, I guess the first thought is that with the terrible disruption to the refinery industry, that we might see a slowdown in the crude trade, crude imports. But in fact, you think the opposite may be the case, that with the improvement in the margins, that we'll see more crude running into the U.S. Did I understand?
Well, not necessarily into the U.S., but the kind of the overall output of refined products have been kind of hindered or disrupted to the tune of 4 to 5 million barrels per day, which is significant kind of in the global. Mm-hmm. You know, U.S. Gulf Coast is similar size of Europe when it comes to refining capacity. So it is a big kind of thing.
Yeah. Scott, Paul, anything you'd like to add?
No, as far as the disruptions are concerned or what happened there, I was on holiday, so I didn't notice that.
We've got good demurrage rates, though.
Well, the market's not been kind to crude tankers over the course of the past 12 months, maybe over the course of the last 24 months. But as we heard earlier from Martin, and I think we've heard reiterated by many, this is a cyclical business. We're all in the business to some extent because it's cyclical and we see opportunities. I'd like to maybe walk down through the panel and have you each describe why you think now is a good time to be in crude tankers and what you see the market looking, why you see this as being a favorable investment opportunity. Lars, we'll start with you.
Well, you know, there are a few moving parts here, and I'd like to kind of, at least from our point of view, kind of comment a few of the things that led up to this. So we are in a very big year in delivering new buildings. We're also in a very big year with regards to dry docking pre-September. And those of you not familiar with tankers, when a tanker is either new or ex-dry dock, it doesn't have any approvals. So it needs to fix the first cargo in order to get its first sire and basically the stamps in order. And in order to gain that, you need to discount. So with having that kind of at a pretty high rate, we've had that for the last few months or the last quarter and a half. And add to that in the Middle East where this is kind of their high season in usage of crude. So you know, kind of Middle East burns incremental 1.5 to 2 million barrels of crude extra during the summer for power production in order to cool their homes. So you have all of that on top of each other, and that needs to clear, basically. Mm-hmm. So, but our, you know, for us in the market, you know, the oil is there, the amount of oil is there. The demand is great. Demand picture for oil is fantastic. You're growing at a pretty good pace, a lot of interesting trading patterns evolving, but right now we're just struggling with clearing the position list, basically. So come winter market, this is the seasonal low. I mentioned the refinery runs, kind of September, October is the time of year where global refinery turnarounds, meaning maintenance, is at its absolute highest. So I think kind of we were in the doldrums. We've been here before. It will be interesting to see what happens going forward.
Lois.
Yeah, so I would start with the demand side, you know, really ton-mile demand on the crude side, and just, you know, worldwide next year we should have consumption around 100 million barrels a day. So we've had really strong compounded growth over the last several years. And the countries that will be increasing oil production will be the U.S., Brazil. So you've got emerging markets pulling it and OECD producing it. So that's good for ton-mile. And then I think on the supply side, for us, International Seaways is a new company, you know, to come out during a time when asset values are as low for an entry point as they have been really in decades is, you know, quite positive for us. So we really look at it as a time for, you know, us to have to be able to renew the fleet. And, you know, we're not looking for new buildings. You know, we look to make moves very steadily. We bought a couple of Suezmaxes last quarter. So you have a strong order book, but you also have pent-up scrapping. You haven't seen very much at all in 2015, 16, 17. And you're just starting to see that now with rates being as low and returns being as low as they are. And then an owner looks at maybe the third special survey, the fourth special survey with a little bit of a more careful pencil.
Thanks.
On January 1st this year, I didn't have a lot of hope, so I predicted $500 scrap by the end of the year. And that's because I had no other hope with the order book the way it was. As it happens, scrap is looking a little bit better. You know, we, as everyone here, we own ships. So on the one hand, you're hoping for a buying opportunity. On the other hand, you want to make some money. And this is the push-pull we all live through. And, you know, in a perfect world, I wouldn't own any ships right now. I have a whole bunch of cash, and I go out and buy. And I think if you have a, you know, a balance sheet with just cash and no ships, it's probably a good time to start collecting some assets because their historical numbers are they're low. They're below depreciated replacement cost. As everyone said, you know, maybe next year or the next 6 months is going to be great, but sometime in the next 18 months or 2 years, we should have a boom. And those low asset prices will pay off.
Yeah, I think carrying on from some of these other comments, we have just seen some of the highest scrapping in the last couple of years in August by itself. And so there are some green shoots that we start to see. We start to see that the tanker supply and demand fundamentals will start to cross as we get into probably the second half of next year. And if we do look at that, you know, from a tanker point of view, and then you say, well, how are the equities going to trade? Because obviously they've been trading rather poorly as well. The markets will typically look 6 to 9 months in advance. So if we were to back that up, then I think that now from a not only from an asset, you know, acquisition point of view, but also from an underlying tanker equity point of view, that window will probably stay where it is for the next maybe month or so. But as you start to see a winter rally and people start predicting that the second half is going to be strong, we do think that there'll be a lot more interest in the equities in advance of that stronger market that we're predicting for late 18 and into 2019.
Thank you. Paul?
Okay, we look at the world from a slightly different perspective. We aim to build vessels with a charter attached. We try to secure alliances with major charterers and build ships for them, which they will then charter. So we're a little out of the regular scenario of tanker shipping. We look at ourselves as an industrial company, and we're looking out for opportunities, further opportunities. We believe that the market will improve over the next 2 years. We believe it is a good time to acquire new vessels. Obviously, we've done a lot. We're a little bit exhausted. We've got one more vessel to take on. But we still have an appetite. If we can negotiate with charterers to build vessels for them, we will go ahead and do so. If we see resales appearing, we will look at them very closely, and we'll put them, if we acquire them, we'll put them immediately on time charter. And that's basically the way we see the world at the moment.
I'm a little surprised I didn't hear more about the U.S. export, crude export story from the panel. This is one of the big developments as far as we can see, and with a lot of very long-haul trade going to China out of our backyard.
Which is full of surprises up here, Ali.
It is amazing, and it's one of those, if you take a look back over the past 5 years, but, I mean, Bob, we talked about shale oil, but how did we ever think that we were going to see the extent of the production and the export growth? But if we take a look, with the benefit of what we now know, do you see that that long-haul trade being a significant driver of crude demand, VL demand in particular?
Well, I think it will kind of play a key role. For those of you not familiar with I'm talking like I'm an American here, but I previously mentioned the U.S. Gulf Coast is a massive refining region. At the same time, these refineries are actually set up to run Middle East crude, and the very light shale crude doesn't really fit these refineries too well. So it means that you export light material that fits perfectly in a Chinese refinery, and then you import heavier crudes from the Middle East, which ton-miles-wise is any ship owner's kind of wet dream. So I think absolutely it's going to be a very interesting trade going forward. You have some logistical issues or constraints as it is, but we're kind of all for U.S. fracking in this respect.
Lois, that used to be, I think we used to think of crude exports from the U.S. as maybe Aframax or Suezmax, but that's been changing a lot recently, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, something like 50% of the exports have been on VLCCs,
right,
with the other portion really, you know, destined for the East, right, that half, and the rest kind of going to Europe. One thing, you know, the inefficiencies we like, Lars, right? So that's good. You know, right now you need to lighter. Corpus Christi did get approved to deepen the draft there, but it would still be for only partial loading of E, and it would be done by 2020.
Okay.
So, you know, that works. Inefficiency is very good for crude tankers because the AFRAs bring it out, put it on the V. And I think the other thing that's interesting is right now, WTI is about $5 below Brent. So, you know, as those ports open up, you know, and you've got a little bit of extra crude that's built up from the hurricanes, you know, you should see stronger exports, I would think, in the fourth quarter out of the Gulf.
Scott, as you look at the North American exports, how is it in fact impacting your business?
Yeah, I think we, now that we're up to around 1 million barrels per day of production, we see that over the next 5 years growing by about another 2 million barrels per day. And if we look at some of the trades that are now just emerging, we've recently just seen a cargo that's been sold from North America to China. We have another one that was sold to India recently. And so these are new trade routes that we wouldn't have predicted even 2 or 3 years ago. And it really is benefiting all different ship sizes, where you've got the smaller ships, like Lois was saying, where you got the reverse lightering that's taking place, where you're taking Aframaxes out of the Gulf or out of the ship channels, reverse lightering to VLCCs to go long haul. And so we think that given that there is a shortage of refining capacity and, you know, this side of the Suez and long on the other side, that this new trade route will help and help to sop up a lot of the tonnage that has been coming out recently and that we do expect to continue through this year and into next year. So it is definitely an exciting development.
One of the remarkable facts that we've pieced together recently is that the North America has become a net hydrocarbon exporter, or if it hasn't already, will shortly become a net hydrocarbon exporter. If you look at the LNG movements out of the U.S. Gulf, as well as the crude and the product movements, you see that the U.S. has moved to has moved to a near balance position, and of course the Canadian and Mexican is mostly over the land. So truly amazing changes in the business. Just to complete, or to take one more stop along the tour of the demand side, Marsoff numbers indicate that the Chinese SPR build was a very significant factor in the first half demand side. But we are not clear that SPR build is going to be continuing. I think there's a third phase of that program. Paul, I detect a degree of skepticism at your end of the table.
If you're looking at the second half of the year, unfortunately, we're well into it and well through it. Quarter three is going to be badly hurt by the fact that the Chinese are doing their refinery maintenance now. And that's led to quite a significant drop in imports into China. Now, of course, that's not lost forever. It's just put off and might go into quarter four and quarter one and add to the seasonal uplift that we would expect to see in those quarters. So that might be make that particular period more pleasant. But for the moment, I think we're getting hurt in quarter three by the maintenance. And you'd think that many hands would make light work, but it seems they take a long time over it.
Cut?
Yeah, maybe just building on what Paul is talking about, we do see that the third phase of the Chinese SPR is in progress. We've had about 150 million of storage that we think is still to be filled between now and 2020, so that's roughly 100,000-125,000 barrels per day. But as you said, it will be lumpy. The Chinese have chosen to be smart about when they buy, and they usually are able to buy the dips in the oil price, and so we do expect it to be lumpy, but there is still this large demand that we do expect to come from China, filling up the remainder of their third phase SPR over the next 2 or 3 years.
Now, panelists, I've got to tell you, I was literally taken aside this morning by someone who said, Arla, you've got to challenge them. These guys have got to be aware that the market cap of Tesla makes it one of the largest automobile companies in the world, that DNDGL has just told us that it's peak oil in 2025, I think they've told us, peak oil demand, excuse me. So you all, and I will attribute this question to this unnamed person who took me aside this morning, but aren't we kind of being a little more optimistic about the oil trade than we should be, given these long-term trends, this technology shifts from internal combustion to electricity and change in the environmental regulations and perspectives? Why should we be optimistic about long-term growth in oil trade?
We have to be.
Because we're owners. Okay.
Otherwise, you don't get this job.
That's a good place to start.
But when I have some graphs. I've been asked this question many times. And we can all throw a lot of statistics around. There were a couple of interesting ones. Less than 1% of the cars in the world are electric, which that can happen very quickly. They can come into mass production very quickly. But it's not completely analogous to coal, but I think peak coal was, I think it was 15 years ago. And I took a graph, and I wish I had it, I put it up, and coal doubled in size, doubled in volume from when oil came as a significant factor until peak coal 15 years ago. So if the absolute volume continues to increase, absolute demand for hydrocarbons, absolute demand for energy continues to increase. It doesn't mean that tankers become obsolete. And, tankers live 20 years. And, we've faced faster disruptions in the market than a couple percentage points a year.
Yeah, just to add to that, because there are as many opinions as on peak oil demand as there are analysts, I think. And, some are around the 2025, others are 2030, some even positive all the way up till 2050. So it's, from some of the stats that I've seen, and, obviously we all want a green planet and renewables and all that stuff, but, at what point in the crude demand are we getting there? Is it going to be when we're at 110 million barrels per day or 130 million barrels per day? For sure it's going to be higher than we are now. And the other thing is that, the growth in renewable or kind of renewable energy into the energy mix. So 3.2 or 3.5% of the energy mix is renewable energy right now. Hmm. And it's growing at an annual pace of 13 to 14%. So it's going to take us some time, 13% of 3.2%. It's not kind of exponential growth there, so it's gonna take time. But obviously, it's something you have to consider. I don't think you need to be too worried right now, kind of investing in the tanker industry.
I would agree. What's interesting. Clearly, many different entities are now doing these studies, but I always talk about the BP 2030 study,
right.
And now I've been reading it every year just to see, to gauge the pace of change, because, obviously, I think as alternate technology comes on, some things become more financially viable, others less. So, it, you know, but their projection for oil would be a smaller piece of the pie, but still something like 30% in 2030, mm-hmm. something like 28%. We would go from 33% now of the energy mix worldwide to like 28%. So it's just, you know, something we all have to be wise and watch and evolve as the world does, right?
Paul, Scott, anything from your end of the table? I'm sorry, the angle is a little difficult here as I look around.
No, I'd agree that it would be a little premature to take any action which actually costs at the moment. We have to wait and see what happens. In the meantime, there are things that we can do, and what we are doing, in fact, as you know, I mentioned the couple of LNG carriers, is probably taking a closer look right. at LNG. It looks like the stars are beginning to align themselves as far as LNG is concerned. So it's worth us taking a closer look. We started off with two to understand the business, and we're looking possibly to expand on that. So you know, next time I come, you know, I'll talk about half a dozen, not just a couple. So.
By the way, the audience should be reassured. An internal combustion engine has started just behind the panel, and it is consuming oil as we speak, so it's also a little bit noisy. I apologize for that. But I wonder if the notion of a peak oil demand might have an influence on the strategy that you, as you look forward to fleet renewal and fleet replacement. If you think that there is a scenario under which oil demand is peaked, and that doesn't say that oil trade is peaked, of course, as I think, Lois, you were pointing out, there's lots of moving parts in this. But would it suggest, perhaps, that buying 20 years worth of ship is not such a good idea in a world of declining oil demand? And would it change your attitude, or do you think it might change the attitude of the industry towards between new building and the acquisition of secondhand ships?
Arlie, you went from, you know, peak in 10 years to we're declining.
Well, all right, fair enough. But peak often has the notion that there's a decline. But I did get a little bit ahead of myself on that one.
The kind of in the oil tanker industry, we are facing very much like Europe, facing a little bit of a demographic challenge. So the fleet is aging quite quickly.
Right.
So it means kind of to renew the fleet and to keep it within kind of the 15 or 20 year, whatever you fancy, we actually need to order ships. So and that's just if demand levels here. So I, you know, for us, we don't really look at it like that at all. We need to renew our own fleet in order to keep our earnings potential. And then we kind of sit back and watch what the analysts are saying about kind of further out the curve.
I think we've got some other demographics at play, just going back to your earlier point about peak demand. There's estimates that there's going to be a billion more people in the next 7 years who want to move up the chain and join the middle class within the world. And so cars are one thing, you know, but the petrochemical industry, the fertilizer industry to feed all of these people, so on a worldwide basis, the demand for oil is going to continue to grow along with these demographical shifts, which are, as we all know, are kind of slow-moving glaciers. But once they're in place, it's very difficult for them to back off. And once you've attained that status and maybe you have your first car or you have to feed all these people, those things don't typically reverse. They don't reverse quickly. And we talked about the number of cars and moving towards electric cars, and that's important. But we also have to remember that the heavy transport, whether it be ships or whether it be airlines or the majority of trade is still moved through, you know, oil and you know, whether it be products on airplanes, and that hasn't changed really in well, not in my lifetime, and I don't know if we're going to see those ships today look very much the way that they did many, many years ago. And so efficiency gains have been gained, but they've been really gained on the edges, and so really it's the demand from these billion more people that want to attain status that we think will continue that oil demand for you know, many years to come.
Hmm. It's when people talk about reduction in oil demand, it's like the U.S. government talking about budget cuts. They never cut the budget. They cut the rate of increase. But everyone hears budget cuts, and they think everything's being cut. It's not. And just a comment about volatility and the business we're in. I think when we look at projects, I think when we all look at projects, the threat of something in the next 3-4 years, a huge order book, any other economic disruption far outweighs, which is sudden and unpredictable. And we understand we're in a business that's sudden and unpredictable, and that's why we play in it, is much more threatening than a curve that's going to move over time. And the curve will move, and none of us really know. No one knows where it's going to move, but it's not going to move like that next day. Whereas all of a sudden someone can, PE comes in or German KGs and order a kajillion ships. That's a lot more dangerous to us and a lot less predictable. So that curve moving over time, we'll all move it. But it's not going to drive our investment decisions, I don't think.
Let's talk a little bit about investment decisions. One of the things that is really striking is as my colleagues and I look at the dry bulk, compare and contrast the dry bulk and tanker markets. And the thing that there are many, many things which are different, but one of the key things which is different is that until recently, no one's been ordering a bulker. But even when rates are low, tanker ordering has carried on at a surprisingly high pace. VLCCs appear to have been a very popular commodity in the new building sector. Why are people building new ships now? New tankers, excuse me.
Well, I think we're back to this demographical crisis in kind of the age profile of the vessels. Because in a tighter, much tightening regulatory kind of framework, the ship's age has come into play. And some charters are advocating for 17 and a half year old vessels at max. Others, actually a lot, have a cap at 15 years. And then you're actually, so the lifetime of the vessel is actually not as long as a bulker. And if you look at the years back when we had the high delivery vessels, we see that we were kind of coming into those kind of slots now where the fleet needs to be renewed. So it's actually called for having having new orders put on. The challenge we have is that the older vessels are not ending up on a beach. They're kind of being employed otherwise. So, and scrapping prices haven't really been favorable until now.
Well, now they are, of course. Lois, I think you had a little different view on where the sweet spot was in terms of investment.
I think the right approach is, we continue to feel that we can find, well-described secondhand tonnage. And I do agree that there's an aging of the profile. That's what I mentioned earlier. There hasn't been a lot of elimination from the fleet. But, we still feel that there are opportunities and we are refraining from ordering at this point in time.
Yeah, I just want to add for Frontline's sake, we're not ordering new tonnage. We're replacing tonnage. That's basically what we've done. In deadweight terms, we haven't really grown over the last couple of years.
Paul?
I think the answer as to why people are ordering, or certain people are ordering, is just basically simple. I mean, there is a genuine belief that there is going to be a real recovery over the next 2 years or so, the time in which to build a vessel. Prices are very low. The yards are offering super deals. You've got a potential asset play that, let's face it, owners have been gamblers for millennia. And if that opportunity is there, that you believe there's going to be a recovery, it's relatively cheap now, let's put our money in it. If we can't trade it, maybe in 2 years' time, when the vessel is coming online, we can sell it and make a very considerable profit. And as your own Marsoft report indicated, the potential increases in asset prices in 2 or 3 years, given the high case scenario, are tremendous. Very, very attractive.
Bob?
If you think prices are going to increase in 2 years, the best ship to buy, I think, is a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. The risk of buying an expensive asset and funding it for 2 years in a volatile market where you really have a foggy view at best. You may have a view, but the punter's chance of getting it right in 2 years is expensive. So for our money, we'd rather buy secondhand ships when we think the market is, we can get cash flow immediately. And if we're right, then we'll do just as well or better than a new build. There's a lower capital cost.
I thought you all were going to say that the one good reason to build a ship is that it's much cheaper to put a scrubber on board when you build it than when you've already owned it. You all thinking about putting scrubbers on your ships?
Next question.
Bob, let me ask the question again. Tell me about scrubbers. Oh, wait a second.
When
wow, look at that. Look at that. We have absolutely...
When is it paid for a ship owner to be a first mover? When has it paid for a ship owner to be a first mover?
Well, that's an interesting question.
It doesn't.
Gentlemen, ladies, we'll leave that hanging. We'll leave it to the next panel to answer the remaining questions. Thank you all so much.
We have a question.
Hi. Nick Zappos. I just want to make a point. Lars, you rightly said that we have problems when a ship goes for a special survey or a dry dock. It's very hard after that to charter it. Intertanko, which I know you're members, and whoever is not a member should become a member. We are in discussions with OCIMF, and now they're allowing inspectors at the special survey dry dock area, so this will not happen. So that's just a thing we took over, because I think that was a terrible situation. I mean, you had a ship becoming a better ship, and then you couldn't charter it. So support Intertanko, and I agree with Bob, no new buildings.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Thank you.